Einen wunderschönen guten Morgen. Das ist kleines Filmröhrchen. They sind großer Fan von Bad Apple und außerdem spielen they gerne mit Mikrocontrollern rum. And was wäre besser, als diese beiden Passionen zu verbinden? Und naja, dabei ist ein Videocodec herausgekommen. Viel Spaß damit!
Audio.
Es sollte Audio offen Dingens sein. Dankeschön.
Hello and welcome everyone to my talk about how I accidentally invented a video codec and played Bad Apple at really low FPS. As I said on the first slide, there are some audio glitches, and unfortunately there were some audio glitches in the latter half. But yeah, so I also didn't beat Faxes at Image Compression, and as you could tell, I also played Bad Apple at a really low frame rate. So this video codec achieves lossless compression of roughly 20 to 25%. So Bad Apple at the resolution that I'm using, which is 80 by 64, monochrome, it's running at 9 FPS at the moment. It's 1,972 frames. And if we just take the raw data, that's roughly 1.2 megabytes. And with my compression, that's only 276 kilobytes. I collect my conference microphones. Sometimes I give them back. I'm known for all of these various things. Most importantly, I've worked on this project for too long. I like microcontrollers. I like random shit like data compression. Data compression is cool because you can cram a lot of stuff into very small space, and we'll see how that works today. So, show of hands, who actually doesn't know what Bad Apple is? Oh, that's actually quite a lot of people. Okay, so I'm going to do the introduction, otherwise I would have just skipped this slide. The demo that you just saw is called Bad Apple, technically with three exclamation marks, but they're mostly left out. So it's a kind of bit hard to explain. The original is a track from the video game Lotus Land Story, which is the fourth game in the Toho series, which is a very famous bullet hell video game series. And this version is very different from what you just heard. The main commonality is the melody. And what you heard was the very popular cover from Masayoshi Minoshima and Nomiko in 2007, it blew up. Like, they all wrote all the lyrics and did most of the work here, so it's really only this melody that's in common. And then people on Nico Nico Doga started storyboarding a music video, and someone requested, please animate this storyboard. And then after some other tries, Anira and other animators put together this shadow puppet video that you saw, they're using 3D animation, but they're like portraying it in this shadow puppet way. And quite honestly, I think it's a great piece of art. And also, all of the characters and all of the themes that you see in the video are based on the Toho video game series. And I have no clue about Toho lore, but people that do say it's really, really, really lore accurate and really great, the kind of stuff that they did. So it's just generally a great piece of art. But of course, apart from some scenes, you might have seen the scene with the sun in the sky. Apart from scenes like that, most of the video is just black and white. So, basically, if a display or if any system can display two different colors, things that are roughly black and roughly white, it should be able to play Bad Apple. So it kind of became the standard full motion two color video, not full motion full color video, but yeah, just two colors. If you go on the talk slides later, which I will upload, basically every single one of these words is a separate link. People have ported it to every computer system imaginable, every non-computer system imaginable, also crazy things like, Soviet plasma panels, Tesla coils, lasers, r/plays. They played it last time on the canvas. And also, of course, various microcontrollers. Windows Task Manager CPU levels, they did that. Like, there's tons of really great stuff. And my demo is not particularly special in comparison, even though I have sound, because most of them either don't have sound or have very dumbed down sound. So I'm briefly going to talk about the demo itself. As I've already mentioned, or as was on the slide multiple times, there is an ESP8266 running here. Basically, everything that's running is running at the maximum speed that I could achieve. There is an SD card connected, which contains the audio. And there's the display that you saw. It's these the monochrome I2C OLED displays that are really nice. And the audio is played back from the SD card with libflac, so it's just a normal FLAC file. It's played over an I2S DAC. The DAC wasn't in the in the video, in the camera, but if you come over here later, maybe you can see that there is actually a deck going on. There's no trickery. And the video playback is not playing from the SD card. The video is playing back from Flash using my custom codec at 80x64. And there is also some AV sync. You might have noticed the audio was getting choppy towards the end. That was not intended, but the video was also getting slower because it's specifically paced to the audio. So it's not just playing at a random speed. Yeah, but what I think is maybe a bit interesting is that this is all running in software, and it's also not exclusive because there is like a whole other thing that has nothing to do with Bad Apple running on this system, and it's running in the background, and I can still navigate through the menu and stuff. So I don't know, maybe that's good. And it's also still running the network stack. I didn't disable it or anything. So really, execution speed is mostly not the issue. At least as long as the compiler inlines the right things. Sometimes it doesn't, but that's a different story. The main issue really was size, because I had this line of code quite a few times where just it complained that there wasn't enough size for the IROM 0 text segment, whatever that means, not important. Yeah, I could have played the video from the SD card, of course. Would have had plenty space, but that's not particularly fun. The cool thing about this demo is that it will continue playing even if the SD card is unreachable. In fact, it will, as you saw at the very end of the demo, it just looped around without the audio, so it's just playing the video on its own. And I can pull out the SD card right now, and it might continue working, but I'm not going to do that because I don't trust any of this. Image compression of monochrome images is a solved problem. Faxes did it in 1988. Wouldn't be a talk on a German hacker conference without mention of faxes, so here we go. So there's the facsimile coding schemes and coding control functions for group 4 facsimile apparatus recommendation ITU T.6, which is a very long way of just saying group 4 encoding or whatever. It's just a 12-page standard. You can read it. You can encode TIFFs with it. And I already knew about this. This standard is very good. If we take the TIFF images that fall out of compressing all the individual frames, we get around 33.6% of the raw data. And this is the format that I'm going to use, and you will see this table multiple times today. However, if we remove all the TIFF metadata, which is almost the exact same size as the actual image data, then we get 16.6%, and usually it goes much, much lower than that. It's only because the frame size is so small. This is already, I can spoiler you, this is already the best that we will ever do, the 16.6%, so I'm not going to get better than that. So, yeah, CCITT group 4 is not super simple. You know you're in for a treat when the codec's technical name is modified relative element address designate. Yes, there's two modifiers in that name, modified read or MMR or whatever. The basic idea is kind of simple. You have the current scan line, you have the previous scan line, they're called reference line and coding line, and then you encode the difference in the starting points where a certain row of black or white pixels start. This diagram is from the standard, and I think it does a good job of roughly giving you an idea of how that works. But then you have these differences, and these differences have different ways of being encoded, and then there's giant Huffman tables, and I don't know, the simplest C implementation I found was 1,000 lines of code. Python still is 400 lines of code. It's not super simple for just compressing monochrome images. I just haven't really spent the time to investigate this in detail. Otherwise, maybe I would have explained it. Maybe this talk would have been less interesting. I don't know. So there is an implementation of this format for various Arduino-compatible microcontrollers because it's actually quite good for storing large images for like e-ink displays and stuff on these small microcontrollers in Flash. However, it was completely bugged on ESP8266, And I talked to the author, and they believed that the compiler was doing something wrong until they noticed that they were doing something wrong in their code, which is usually how it goes. I still have the plan. Maybe I'm going to do that today later. I don't know. You can bug me about that to actually try his updated code because he fixed the bugs apparently. But that wasn't the case when I was working on this. So let's roll our own. How hard could it be? So this is what frame 21, I think, of the video looks like. Good thing you've all seen the video, so you will recognize these frames. And the thing that we always want to start with when we are trying to design a compression codec is we want to find certain patterns in the data that we can exploit to store it in a very efficient way. So in this case, we can notice that there is very large blocks of the same color, basically. So we're going to store this image in the same way that Group 4 does it, or that many other codecs do it, which is scan line by scan line, row by row. And if we go like that here, we can immediately tell there's like 30 white pixels in the beginning, and then there's 40 black pixels probably, and then there's a bunch of more white pixels, and they even continue on the next scan line. You might just treat them as one block of white, because we don't actually need to store the resolution, it's just fixed. So instead of storing all of these individual pixels like we're doing here and needing 1 byte per 8 pixels, which is still quite expensive, we could just somehow say, well, repeat the white pixels 30 times, and then we just need to store the number 30 and maybe some additional information. And that's probably the simplest encoding scheme that exists, which is called run length encoding. And that literally means we store the run length of a certain value. And something we can make use of here is that we only have two kinds of runs. We only have black pixels and white pixels. So we don't even need to store what kind of run we have, because we know after white run, there will always be a black run, and after black run, there will always be a white run, and so on and so forth. So we can just say, okay, they are alternating. So this is the actual real runs from this image. As I said, there was like 30 white pixels, then, okay, I miscounted, 34 black pixels, then the 46 white pixels are the ones that start in the first line, continue in the second line, and so on and so forth. This sounds like a vaguely very good idea, but we're going to need to do a bunch of stuff beyond just this simple case to make it work in practice, which is always the difference between what your data compression lecture tells you and what you actually have to do. So first problem, I am just going to tell you right now, and you'll find out later why, that we only have 7 bits for storing a run. So what if a run is longer than 127 pixels? We can make use of something that we didn't that I didn't talk about before, that we have zero length runs, and maybe before you've already thought about them and think that's useless. We could store it biased, if you know what that means. But no, actually, zero length runs are useful, because if we take longer runs and split them up into 127 maximum chunks, then we can use zero length runs in between them, which just means store no pixel of this color, which just means no data, which is totally fine, according to our old interpretation. We can do something like this white run of 269 pixels. And this is the first convenient thing that zero length run does for us. The second convenient thing is that technically we didn't yet define what the first run color is. Maybe we could have had like a special value in the beginning that tells us this, but actually more conveniently we can just say arbitrarily the first run is black, and then just store a zero length black run in the beginning if the first pixel is actually white. So that's also what is happening here. So this would be a mostly white frame probably, and it starts with a lot of white pixels, so that's why we have this encoding here. So this is actually almost already practically usable. There are some other optimizations we can do, though. First of all, if we know that how many pixels there are. So if we haven't filled the entire image yet, we can just arbitrarily say, let's fill it with the next run's color, because often on the bottom of the frame there will be a lot of the same color, so we can just not store that. So of course a completely black frame will contain no data, and a completely white frame will just contain a single zero, because we need the initial zero length run for black, so that the next run's color is white and we fill the entire frame with white. And as you might know, in the beginning there is a bunch of black frames, there's some white frames intermediately, and they compress extremely well, of course. As I was trying to say, because I forget how my talk is structured, this scheme is already kind of good, but we have some situations where it really breaks down. Namely, frames like this one. These are the ones that have grayscale in the original image, and so my conversion from a grayscale to monochrome does dithering. This is completely intentional because it looks great. However, it creates all of these single white pixels. And those create runs like this, like with 2, 1, 10, 1, like there's always single white pixels and very short runs of black pixels. And if we need 7 bits for all of that, you might notice that it takes much more storage space than actually just storing it uncompressed. And we are going to look at a better solution to this problem later on. However, first of all, we want to look at a way that we can improve our hourly scheme. So what we're really looking at here is some way of encoding numbers with less bits if they appear more frequently and are therefore more likely to appear and therefore have less entropy. If you know about how entropy works in physics, it's related to probabilities effectively. That's why it's called entropy coding. Also, if you know about information theory, that's also related. But I don't want to get into the theoretical details because nobody will care. So the cool thing about entropy coding is that it's used literally everywhere, because it will do this thing very well if you design it properly, spend very few bits on things that are very common. Like Huffman coding, you know, is a kind of entropy coding, technically not quite, but let's forget about that. There's Elias Delta coding and there's Rice-Coulomb coding, and those are used in the standard codecs that you are all using in both lossy and lossless ones. So we're not going to deal with actual entropy coding just yet. We're going to deal with a more simple form of entropy coding that I made up on my own for now, which I call the simple nibble compression, or just the nibble compression. Because nibbles, the 4-bit units will be involved. So we use the most significant bit of a byte to switch between two kinds of bytes. If we have a 1, then we have a single 7-bit run, and this is the reason that I restricted our runs to 7 bits. However, if we have a 0, then we have 2 runs, a 1 with 3 bits, because we need that 1 bit as a signal, and 4 bits in the lower nibbles. And those can be 2 consecutive runs, which are relatively short, but actually for the case that we had up here, this would like half the amount of memory that we need for this. So it's actually quite good. And yeah, I already implemented this, so I didn't show you any comparisons beforehand, because I actually didn't implement the pure RLE on its own. I actually just implemented this, and it's already down to 31.6%, which is pretty great. We're beating the TIFF container. I also implemented the LEB128 variable length code, if you know about that one, which is pretty horrible, so I'm not going to talk about it. But if you actually do a proper entropy code, like Rice-Coulomb coding, it doesn't actually get that much better. And that's also why I initially didn't try it, and that was also my suspicion. So yeah, we've made some progress. Like, we're better than TIFF. We're 31.6%. But I promised you a lot more, so let's revisit those single pixels. In a sense, our images are made up out of two kinds of data. First of all, there's long runs where nothing really changes. And second, there's things like the borders of objects and whatnot, especially when there's dithering, there are short bursts where there's a lot of change. So we kind of want to have an encoding scheme that can encode both efficiently. So this is a solved problem also. Thumbnail doesn't load. Great stuff. Anyways, Retro Game Mechanics Explained has an explainer video on the Pokemon Generation 1, so red and blue and yellow, sprite compression, because of course they had a Game Boy and Game Boys don't have a lot of memory and they wanted to have a lot of really large sprites for Pokemon in battles. So they compressed all of their Pokemon sprites and decompressed them on the fly whenever you battled a Pokemon. And the reason actually this video exists is that the way that the compression algorithm works and the way that it breaks down when you give it garbage data is what explains how the glitch Pokemon Missing No appears in the Generation 1. So if you want to know about how Missing No gets its experience, its appearance, very good English, you should watch this video and the previous one that actually explains the Missing No glitch. I'm using some of Retro Game Mechanics Explained's video stills with permission. So the way that Pokemon did it is slightly more involved than what I need for my purposes. So I'm going to go through the initial part relatively quickly because it's not relevant for our case. First of all, they of course had four colors of gray or four colors of garbage green, as to quote Michael Steil. They split them into 2-bit planes with 1 bit per pixel each, which is just like what we do or what we have here with monochrome. Then they have some ways of merging them with XOR. Then they can optionally delta encode the pixels, going to talk about that in a moment. And then they group the bits into 2-bit pairs. But first, let's talk about the per pixel deltas. The idea is that you encode each pixel, not on its own, but as the difference from the previous pixel. In 1 bits, you can just do that with an XOR, like always pixel with previous pixel, and also wrapping around on the scan line. And you can see that it mostly creates a black image because all the runs become black and all the borders become white. It's a very primitive way of doing edge detection in 1 bits, I guess. But this actually gives us the property that all the runs, which we want to encode efficiently, will all be black, will all be zeros. So now what we can do, we have 2-bit groups always. What we can now do is we can say we only store runs of 0-0-bit pairs because those will be the long runs where nothing changes, like solid black or solid white. And on the other hand, all the things that contain at least 1-1 will be stored as an uncompressed data packet. So the way that the data packet works is we store the uncompressed data, like one of these 3-bit pairs, until we reach a 0-0-bit pair, because of course the 0-0-bit pair will be encoded in an RLE packet and not in a data packet, so we can use it as a marker, which is quite clever. And this actually gives us like almost a 1-to-1 compression ratio for all the bad parts, for all the bursts that I talked about earlier. And the RLE packets, we have to do something special for that. We have to do something like we did earlier. However, in this case, we need to, or at least Pokemon, they went a bit further. They went a bit more involved with how they want to store that. So we actually want to do something properly with variable length encoding. So we want to use a variable number of bits for a varying number of, varying values. So the most simple variable length code is unary, which is literally just counting, like you have as many symbols as the number is large, which means that smaller numbers will be encoded more efficiently, of course. But of course, this is not efficient in general. It's just, it takes a lot of bits for even relatively small numbers, like the number 9 here, for example. To be encoded in comparison to raw binary. But of course, for raw binary, we don't know where the start of a number is, so it is not what's called a prefix-free code. Going to mention that word at least once more. So also the way that we store unary here is that we have a terminator 0 technically we could just use the same symbol. So if you're doing hash marks on your wall because you've been in your prison cell for 1,000 days, you're of course just doing hash marks, but it's actually useful to use a terminator symbol or a different symbol for the terminator than for the rest of the run, so that you can detect when the run ends, which is part of this whole prefix thing, that if we're reading through a bitstream like this, we can always detect the end of a number, and then we're decoding the next number, can detect its end, and so on and so forth, which is a very important property if you have variable length codes. So instead of just encoding a number as it's run, maybe we can do something else, because if we look at the number like 45 here in the example, it needs 6 bits in its natural representation. And so what we could just do is encode the number 6 in unary, which tells us that we need 6 bits later, and then encode the number itself, 101101. However, we can do one more trick, which you can see here. The leading digit of any number that is not 0 will always be 1, so we don't even need to store it. It's redundant information. So what we can do instead is we can remove the top 1 bit, and then just encode the rest. So in this case, we just need 5 bits for the 01101, and then we have the 5 in unary at the beginning, as you can see. And for that's for encoding, and for decoding, it's also relatively simple. We just read this unary number, so we read a bunch of ones until we hit the first 0, then we know how many bits more we have to read, and then we can add the top 1 bit as well. This is good. However, there is one significant problem with it. As this slide is going, I have to go a bit faster. This is in O-log n, so it's basically as efficient as binary with just a constant factor. The problem is that 1 is not really encodable with that. If you take 1, you chop off the leading bit, you have nothing left, so you're trying to encode 0, and it's like the empty string doesn't really work. So what we do instead is we add 1 to everything beforehand, so that 1 actually encodes as the 0-0 bit pair, which is coincidentally what we're also trying to encode with the run length. So that's kind of neat. Anyways, that's why I put the number plus 1 in here and the subtract 1 in the decode step. We just have to add it before encoding and subtract it after decoding. That's all we have to do for that. So this is actually almost exponential Goulomb coding or Rice-Goulomb coding with the unary code inverted, so zeros instead of ones. However, I could not actually find the proper name for this encoding scheme. I searched a lot, and it's apparently doesn't exist. So if someone actually knows what the specific run length code that Pokemon uses is called, please let me know. But I couldn't have found a name, so that's why I'm not going to say it's this specific thing. It's just similar to exponential Goulomb coding. Here's a short example. In this case, actually, we need to use an initial bit to tell us whether the first packet is an RLE packet or a data packet. In this case, it's an RLE packet. The number here should be 101, so that would be 5, but we have to subtract 1, so it becomes 4. You can see 4 0 0 pairs. Then we have a short data packet. Then we have a pretty large number. So remember, we read 110, okay, unary 3. We read 3 more bits, 100. And then we add top 1, so we get 1100, subtract 1, and that should be 11, I think, or something like that. And you can see the bunch of zeros. And then there's a couple more data packets, which, as you can tell, don't really add that much in terms of compression overhead. Yeah, so if we do this, this is actually mildly worse than what we did before, which is kind of funny. I still did it, but it will get much better in just a moment. I only have like 10 minutes left. I need to get through everything else. The crucial thing right now is that this table is compressing every single image with the same algorithm, But some algorithms are better for some images than others. So what if we had like an initial header byte which told us which kind of compression method to use for the image? And if we do that, then it actually gets much better. So that actually turns out to be good to have some variability in how you can encode something. Yeah, so we're going to add on top of those algorithms, but this is the basic thing on the lowest level that we're going to do. And now we're going to look back at actually images and what images are, because actually we haven't cared that much about how images work up until this point. Because if you look at the image like this one, it mostly has two parts, a white and a black part. And if you encode this scan line by scan line, it will give you run of black, run of white, one of black, run of white, something like this. However, what if we instead reverse the direction of every second scan line? Then we would have run of black, long run of white, long run of black, long run of white, and so on. So we can do something like this. I hope you could see the arrows. And this kind of snaking back and forth pattern, that's why I called it snake scan line ordering, is actually really good for a lot of images. And what we can do now is we can use our header byte, which we need anyways, to also tell us whether we want to reorder our scan lines in this way. And so we can optionally add that to either the nibble compression or the Pokemon compression. So we have four compression methods now. And that actually yields us almost two more percent. Doesn't sound a lot, but if you do a bunch of these steps, you will get very far, as you will also see in a moment. So the next thing is actually turning our image compression into video compression, because so far we've only dealt with single images. But if we look at the video, you can tell this is somewhere in the middle, frame 1000 something. Oh, actually, I think it's 731, doesn't really matter. I remembered these numbers at some point. These frames are very similar, as you can tell. So in, like we did all of this single pixel deltas before with Pokemon compression. What if we did deltas between, wrong direction. What if we did deltas between these kinds of frames? So we encode every pixel not as itself, but as the difference from the same pixel in the previous frame. So we get a basic form of interframe compression, interframe deltas. So interframe between frames, and that's what all video codecs do, and that's also why I feel qualified to say that this is a video codec, because you can do this. And as you can tell, there is, like before, not a lot of white pixels left, and actually I think many black runs got a lot longer. So this should be advantageous for us, and now we add this as an option on top of the base compression methods. So now we have six methods, and that now actually gets us down to 23.4%, which, as far as I remember, is the final result. That's where I got with this experiment. And I'm almost done with the talk, actually, which is nice. But there were some other things that I tried. So first of all, I tried implementing a simpler version of the Pokemon compression, which I have to admit is still in use currently in the video, because I didn't get around to actually implementing the complicated ones, because it needs a bunch of bitstream reading, and it's like it's not theoretically complicated, it's just practically complicated because of bitstream stuff. But the simpler Pokemon version is only about 1% or 2% worse, and it roughly has the same ideas, so I didn't feel bad about lying to you. Now, the second thing is actually the way that I store the frames in Flash is that I have like byte arrays, unsigned char arrays with the single frames, and then I also have one pointer array which stores the pointers to all of the frames. Which is quite convenient to read out in code. However, of course, I can simply reuse pointers there, so I can reuse old frames. So the compression also checks if there's any frames that already were identical to this one, and we can reuse identical frames. which is kind of like a very crude way of doing interframe compression. And I already did this frame reuse for like basically all the things you can see in this table. So it's also fair, like all of them have already 2% bonus from that. Even the CCITT group 4. So it yields about 2%, or I mean, it doesn't yield 2% compression probably, it yields that 2% of the frames are reused. I didn't actually check what that would be in terms of compression. Now these are the two things that helped that I didn't talk about before. The things that actually went nowhere, some experiments which will always happen if you're doing these kinds of things, is that I tried doing exponential Coulomb with an adaptive coding parameter. You can actually do exponential Coulomb in a different way than what we discussed. And you can have an encoding parameter that is either adaptive to the data, or you can brute force it in advance and pick the best one, but that didn't really help. And I also tried some other image transposition things apart from the snake scan line reordering. I tried rotating the image, transposing it, didn't help all that much. I tried combining a bunch of these algorithms in various ways that were basically not optimal for any kind of frame. So I just dropped them from the selection because it wasn't worth the additional encoding time. And also I tried doing something that real video codecs do, is they split up the image into various blocks and compress those blocks on their own and do various things there. I basically just tried selecting a different compression method for each block, but that mostly made things worse, so I also didn't stick with that. But technically, the code is still capable of doing that if you just change some global variables in the compression script. That brings me nicely to my final slide. The code for all of this is on GitHub. If you look into the very large Python file, you will see a lot of commented out code, a lot of functions that are unused, because like all of this is in there. You should really experiment with it. I don't think it's too hard to read. And also the decompressor is in the SRLV file, which stands for Simple Run Length Video, which is the name that I gave the thing. But anyways, thank you for listening.
Thank you, Filmröhrchen. We have like 15 minutes for Q&A left, so do you have any questions? And by the way, questions that are these things with a question mark at the end, please. Thank you.
So I was wondering if reducing the precision of the image, saying, okay, the minimum size of a pixel is always too long, would help with compression. That would, of course, reduce the image quality that we get.
So you just mean reducing the horizontal resolution to 40 pixels.
Exactly.
That would be lossy compression, but we look at lossless compression specifically.
Sorry.
And also CCITT group 4, if I didn't say it properly, it is completely lossless. It does not throw away a single bit.
Did you do any overview of how much your different ways of compressing affect the binary size? You're working with pretty small data sets. So if I like made a super brilliant algorithm that ends up using like a megabyte of space in the text section, that's probably not a great idea. I don't think it's that extreme, but it would be interesting to see how much did you look at that?
Well, as I told you, if I just throw the uncompressed image in there, it doesn't work. This ESP8266 has 4 megabytes of flash, but you can only really use one for code. And almost half of that is already used by other code. Like I have a whole flag library, I have a whole time zone database, I have a whole bunch of stuff in there. So you have like roughly 500 kilobytes. And the goal also was to be able to increase the frame rate, because I was gradually increasing the frame rate, seeing where I could go. I managed to go to 10 sometimes, but 9 seems to be more stable. So the ratio is mainly for the video compression part, but of course this affects how much data I need, and if I need less data for the same images, I can also increase the amount of images and improve the frame rate.
I understood that you do the decompression on the ESP, or are you, so can you imagine that one would be able to do the compression as well, maybe on an ESP32 with a webcam attached on a downscaled video?
No, I didn't try any of that. Would be a challenge on this kind of old, it's slow. I mean, it's running at 160 megahertz, but if you compare it to That's not the whole story, right? Anyways, I didn't try it. The main problem is that I don't really have a smart way of doing the compression. I mainly try everything, and that gives us the best compression. But still, most of the Python program is just OpenCV going through all the frame grabs that I need, and actually most of it is not spent on the compression. It takes like I think like 1.5 to 2 minutes to compress the entire video, which is, includes all the downscaling and like everything reading in the full original video file. Yeah.
So you mentioned in the beginning that you noticed that the Rice Golom thing is more efficient than your own Nibble thing, but then when you start combining the algorithms, you still use the Nibble algorithm. Why did you do that, and did you try it with the Rice Golom?
I tried it with Rice Golom. Rice Golom gives you like 0.5%, and it's like I don't remember the exact splits. My code can tell you which percent of frames use which codec, and if you want to try that, you can maybe fiddle around with the code and find it out. And also, there should be a larger version of this table in the repo as well. Not sure if that data is in there, but I'm pretty sure that it was so minute, and I didn't really want to go into all the hassle of implementing that. As I've said, I haven't implemented the proper Pokemon codec in C++ either yet. Just implemented in the compression in Python.
Since the network stack is still running, could you stream video to the ESP?
I'm not sure what the maximum bitrate that this thing does is, but it should be enough, but I haven't tried yet, but this is actually an interesting idea. But as I said before, the idea was that this is so self-sufficient that it doesn't even need the SD card, right?
I think you might have already answered this by accident, but how do you choose which compression algorithm to use? Do you just use all of them on every
I use all of them and choose the best one. And Pokemon actually, the Pokemon people did the same. They have like six modes, I think, that they can do. You have to watch the video, it's explained in detail. Various ways of merging the bit planes. And they also just probably tried all of them for every single sprite, because it's actually much cheaper than what I'm doing, and they only have like, 200-something sprites.
Are there any questions left? Ah, yeah, there are.
Let's assume we have an FPGA reading the data, so we would know before we have the image something about the entropy of the image. Would that maybe help us in deciding the proper algorithm for a particular frame without trying all algorithms in parallel?
It might help with specific entropy codes, or like it's easier to do that with specific entropy codes where people have done this kind of analysis. Because for Rice Golom, there is a lot of work on predictive coding and adaptive k-parameters and all that sort of stuff. But for my things, I don't know. Like I would imagine this to be a really complicated problem. This is the main complication behind video compression, is how do I find out what is optimal to do? And what compression is optimal to do without doing everything.
Would it be possible to like split the image in four smaller images and decode it in like different algorithms? And have you tried it? And how hard would it be to do it?
That's what I meant with the compression in blocks. I did try that. It was worse. So
I think that we're... You can put your hand up and then I get to you while the other question works.
So did you go through all that effort just for Bad Apple, or do you have another use case for this?
I went through all of this for Bad Apple. Actually, this is like pretty much everything I would do.
GPMM.